It's nice to see everyone. I like to say 2,500 years ago, the Buddha sat under a tree and solved your problem. He solved my problem. He solved his problem. He solved the human condition. And probably a better word is challenge, but our biggest challenge, the challenge probably of every human, is we only know how to be happy when we're having a pleasant experience. But unfortunately, reality has three slices of the pie. The pear crumble pie of reality has a pleasant slice. Of course, Advaita Siddhanta's every slice is pleasant, very pleasant. But in general, we get the pleasant slice, the unpleasant slice, and the neutral slice. So have you noticed how your moods come and go based on whether or not conditions are lining up in a pleasant way or not? I mean, first of all, we're like in a heaven realm here. I mean, the days, right, are just like beyond belief. Especially, right, that afternoon sun. Ooh, so pleasant. The warmth on the face and the body. Maybe some of you who are just resting by the river. So pleasant. And we're really good at being open-hearted when it's pleasant. Relax, at ease. In Thailand, where you know, I was for 4 months as a monastic, sabai sabai, which is their version of it's all good. Sabai sabai. Also they say, mai pen rai, no problem. Sabai sabai, mai pen rai. Do you know how to be open-hearted when the going gets tough? Do you know how to be open-hearted when it's neutral? I was very pleased. My mom died. That sounds weird. I was very pleased after my mom died. She died April 18th, 5 years ago. And as much as I loved my dad, I was close to my mom. My dad and I just loved each other, but we didn't have a real strong closeness. My mom and I, so close. And so when she died, there was a lot of sadness. And she had a good death, like my dad. All her kids with her. But what I noticed with practice, this was, is because of practice, it wasn't anything I was trying to do. I just noticed there was no resistance to the sadness. There was nothing wrong. There was just sadness whenever sadness arose. And I kept sort of waiting for the reactivity, like, when am I going to be struggling with the sadness? And I never did. And it was just like, I was so grateful to the practice that out of my control, I wasn't trying to do that, but it's just the practice was working through me. And just when you're sad, be sad, you know? There's a quote from Suzuki Roshi, a Japanese Zen teacher, one of the first, you know, really well-known Japanese Zen teachers in the country, founded the San Francisco Zen Center. And he said, the way to be with your pain is to let it be painful. And that teaching was just operating There was just sadness. And there was no problem. And it's what, you know, the Buddha talked about is the second arrow. We, you know, a person gets hit with one arrow, but then they add a second arrow of intense reactivity, of course. Who wouldn't? But that was really cool to see. There just wasn't a second arrow. And I noticed there was an open-heartedness with sadness. And it was just so cool. So this is where our practice is taking us. To actually work with the whole pie. All of experience. The issue is, the real suffering in life is not pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. The real suffering is that when we get what we don't want, it robs us of peace of mind and well-being and being here. We just, you know, reject the moment, and we're off in some la-la land. We're always wanting to be somewhere else. Especially if the going gets rough. So there's a story of a Zen master, and she's on one side of a raging torrent, and her student is on the other side, and he yells across, "Master, how do I get to the other shore?" And the Zen master yells back, "You are on the other shore." There's no river to cross. There's no raging torrent to cross. There's just being where we are. And the single most responsible factor for ejecting you out of the present moment is your relationship with feeling tone, what Dave guided you in this morning. Awakening does not make everything pleasant. The Buddha, 45 years after he woke up, had an experience that was so unpleasant, it killed him. He died of food poisoning. Do you think that was pleasant? A fully awake guy. But he died of food poisoning. I can't imagine that. I had my appendix out in January. That was pretty bad. But man, can't imagine that. That was really unpleasant. But was his mind disturbed? Not according to the suttas, not according to the Pali Canon. He just knew it was his time, and it was unpleasant, and he was still in, you know, Buddha heart, Buddha mind, awake, aware, right here, no problem. Unpleasant? Hell yeah. Problematic? Not a problem. This is where our practice takes us, over time. It's where we slowly, we're all learning this on retreat, right? You can sit a little bit more maybe now with knee pain, or a little bit more with an itch, and instead of scratching it, you just pay attention to it. So we're always kind of hoping we could just align everything just right so it'll always be pleasant. Because we don't know how else to be happy. And so the whole Dharma path is, you know, how to be happy no matter what, no matter what's happening. We could be happy when there's stress. We can be happy when it's just neutral. We'll never get out of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. It's always, no matter how, you know, successful, talented, skilled, you know, famous, whatever, no matter how successful you become, your life is still pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And I heard a interview on NPR, how long ago? I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, And there's recently a book published by Joe Smith, who was with Capitol Records, and he had recorded all the musicians that were interviewed and recorded all the musicians that were being recorded by Capitol Records. So he interviewed. He spent, you know, anywhere from 2 to 5 minutes or 10 minutes interviewing everybody about, you know, just their life. And he eventually published a book of these interviews. And so the book was published a few years back, and he was on NPR about it. So during his tenure, he was there a long time. He recorded Ella Fitzgerald, Ray Charles, Little Richard, David Bowie, Bob Dylan, Paul McCartney, Elton John, Tina Turner, B.B. King, Quincy Jones. Now, I'm old school, so this is, you know, this guy was old school too, but, you know, a lot of the, you know, superstars of the 60s and 70s, all genres of music, jazz, rock, though, you know, there was no, like, hip-hop or rap or anything like that back in the, you know, his day. At least they weren't recording them. But jazz, rhythm and blues, pop, big band, heavy metal, folk, country, western, just everything Capitol Records recorded. So many artists. And, you know, some of his interviews, they played on air. And Ray Charles was just talking about Artie Shaw, who's an old jazz clarinet player. And Ray Charles was just saying, I love him so much, man. I almost cry, literally tears, when Artie Shaw stopped playing. Ever since I was a kid, he was the guy I loved so much. Artie Shaw, to me, had so much feeling in his notes. Every note, you could feel his heart. I have to tell you, man, it's like a person dying. And then there's some recordings, mini recordings. There's a recording with George Harrison. How is it to be George Harrison? It's getting easier all the time. You know, it was very difficult once we got in. I won't do the accent, I'll just botch it. Very difficult once we got into the heavy period of the Beatles in the early 60s and through the mania. That was very difficult. Then we went through the drug period, which scrambled our brains up. And then after the Beatles split, historically, we all know there was all the legal problems. But I'm glad to say I've come out of the other end of that tunnel, and I feel really, really good about it. And I'm a happy person. And Joe Smith asked George about his favorite version of Something. And George said his favorite version, Something was covered by so many artists. His favorite version was James Brown's recording of Something, which that would be interesting to hear. I don't know if James Brown, I always think of everything as so like danceable and funky, and I don't know if he did it like a ballad or not. It'd be interesting to hear. So, at the end of the show, the NPR interviewer, he's interviewing Joe Smith, who had interviewed all the musicians. At the end of the interview, the NPR guy said, when you finished doing the interviews over the 2 years of all the artists, did you find you came away from it with any kind of conclusions about what qualities a lot of these artists shared? Okay. The jazz greats, all the jazz greats, you know, the soul, rock and roll, blues, gospel, all the different, what is the one quality they all have in common? Oh man, right? Passion, creativity, drive, you know. And Joe Smith said this, I felt that if there was one emotion that went through the old ones, the old timers, and the new ones, it was insecurity. The next record, is that going to be a hit? Are they going to continue to be stars and be idolized? Because everybody has the moment when their records were on the charts, the moment when the crowds were at their concerts, and then the moment passes. They remain big and important, but they're not the moment anymore, and that bothers them. Dang, I was not expecting that. Wow, that's what they have in common? Really? Maybe their lives are still pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, and maybe their moods are coming and going, and it's a slippery slope, and they get success, and then they're not as successful, and then they get a little bit more success, but then they're not. didn't all that go away? It just never goes away. And it doesn't go away because our relationship with feeling tone is the core issue. I can say this very categorically, and you might disagree with me, but if you're suffering in any way, you are having an issue with feeling tone. You don't like the thought you're having. You don't like the emotion you're having. You don't like the weather. You don't like your interactions with your teenage daughter. You're stressed at work. There's something unpleasant. And instead of, really being with unpleasant, you're really averse to it and you're really struggling with it. We do the second arrow all the time. We make it worse than it is. Like the singer Bobby McFerrin said, when you have trouble, don't make it double. But that's what we do all the time. So, how do we deal with this? The answer, I believe, is we could summarize the entire Buddhist path, the way we understand it in Theravada Buddhism, which is where our practice is from. We can summarize the answer in a single sentence. So I'm going to give you what I believe to be the essence of the entire Buddhist path in a single sentence. Now, I'm a Vipassana teacher, and we are the talkative tradition. The Zen tradition always bashes us. You guys explain everything. And we say to them, yeah, but you don't have to explain anything. You got it easy. We do have to explain everything, or at least we do. Anyway, a friend of mine, this is an example of a Vipassana teacher doing a talk. We talk a lot. And I busted him because I saw in one of my emails that he had given a talk and there was a recording of it. And the talk was called The Dharma in a Nutshell, Part 2. And I'm like, dude, you didn't put it in the nutshell. I feel like there's a pile of acorns under a tree and you unpeeled every one of them. And now you have to do Part 2. So he's like, damn. Joseph Goldstein, our teacher, one of our teachers, his teacher, Munindra, Joseph would say about him, he would give a Dharma talk until the last person left the room. So I almost did that 2 nights ago. I promise not to do that tonight. But I do have a big task in front of me because I'm going to try to boil down the Buddhist path in a single sentence, but to put it in the proper context so that you would maybe agree with me that this really does sum it all up. I've got to pretty much teach you the whole of Dharma, and then you'll see if that sentence fits in. So wish me luck. I wish you luck. So I want to do the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and the Four Foundations of Mindfulness.
Yeah. We're rooting for you.
You have confidence. Wish me luck. Just set your alarm for 8 o'clock. Okay. And, Dave and I last night, he wouldn't even let me spit out the Four Noble Truths. He's like, no, that's wrong. And I'm like, come on, dude. Everybody knows. Do we know what the Four Noble Truths are? What's the first noble truth?
Suffering.
Yeah, the truth of suffering. There's suffering in life. And really, let's say dukkha, because the word suffering could be problematic. There is dukkha. And what's the second noble truth?
End of dukkha.
The end of dukkha, did someone say? That's the third.
Oh, the cause.
Yeah.
It has a cause.
The cause of dukkha. He wouldn't let me say that, but we'll keep going. And the fourth noble truth?
The Eightfold Path.
So I've always heard it as dukkha, the cause of dukkha, nibbana, or awakening, or happiness no matter what, and then the cause of that. And the Eightfold Path is the whole Buddhist path of wise view and ethics and meditation. I won't get into the nitty gritty of it. There's no time. So we're just going to leave it like that. Dukkha does not exactly mean suffering, because dukkha can be a relationship of stress with happiness or joy. Like, it can be dukkha when we base our happiness on something very fleeting and then it disappears. I don't know if you're like me, there's sometimes when, like, a sunset, do you have this feeling ever? It's so beautiful, it aches. And it aches because you want to, like, grab it. You want to have it. And you just can't. It's just water streaming through your fingers. And it's so poignant. And there's a poem, a very famous Japanese poet, Basho, who was... I think maybe he's from Kyoto, but I don't want to start an urban myth. But his poem includes Kyoto. His little haiku: even when in Kyoto, I long for Kyoto. Oh no, I omitted a line very important in a haiku. Don't omit a line. Hearing the cuckoo's cry. I'm botching it. Even in Kyoto, hearing the cuckoo's cry, I long for Kyoto. That's that quality where it's just, we ache because we just, it's pleasant, but we can't grab it. And that actually is a kind of dukkha. There's something about that that's just, It's unsettling. And you may have had that experience here. You know, we just want to grab all this beauty and just have it. You know, and we might really want to grab it, like on the last day of retreat. I got to take this with me. So the best translation for dukkha that I like is unreliability. Because everything's fleeting and coming and going, we can't sort of build our castle on it, right? Castles made of sand slip into the sea eventually. Stuff just comes and goes. And so does our happiness. So it's a conundrum. This is dukkha. And so unreliability, I think, really points to the key issue. That we're basing our happiness on fleeting things. So therefore our happiness is fleeting. So the second noble truth, I'm going to try to speed up a little bit, is craving is the cause of dukkha, is the cause of that unsatisfactoriness, that slipperiness, the unreliability, or the stress. There's just many different words we could use for dukkha. And, you know, when we're new to Dharma, there's the idea, oh yeah, all desire is suffering. That's the cause of suffering. But that's not really what craving means. What craving actually means is a reactive relationship with feeling tone. It's the three... reactive responses. So when something's pleasant, we try to grab it. So it's greed. When something's unpleasant, we want to push it away. So it's aversion. And if it's neutral, as Dave mentioned this morning, we just ignore it. Because really it is, I mean, from an evolutionary perspective, neutral was probably never really relevant to our survival. So we're actually wired this way. It probably had survival value to have this relationship with feeling tone. But thank God, somehow, evolution designed us to be able to go bigger than all that reactivity. any reactive state, and I'm incredibly grateful to the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, that he made it so simple. Our basic issue is feeling tone because we have a reactive relationship with it. All of our trouble comes from greed, aversion, delusion. And there's many flavors of each of them. Just for instance, aversion, there's many types, right, of not wanting, judging, hating, irritation, impatience, restlessness, jealousy. So you know, I just keep saying it, but like, if you like this approach, you are getting the keys to the universe, and which is really the key to unlock your heart. This is the cause. This is why we suffer. Because we're so kerfuffled by all of the coming and going of feeling tone. Every problem you have in some way boils down to that. I'm being very categorical because I'm pretty sure it's true. So the third noble truth then is really saying there's a different relationship to feeling tone we can have. The third noble truth is nibbana, the truth of happy no matter what. And the Buddha discovered a way to be happy no matter what. So the third noble truth is like proclaiming that. The fourth noble truth is the path. What actually helps all of us, you know, actually develop much more ease and equanimity with feeling tone. What helps us be happy no matter what. And the Eightfold Path, just very quickly, I have a really silly acronym, but the way my memory is, I have to put acronyms on everything. There's eight parts, and you have to pretend you're in France and you're going to buy something and you don't know which credit card to use, the Visa or the MasterCard. This is so weird, but anyway, it works. Visa Le MC. The Le is the French part, okay? So the V stands for, anyone know the Eightfold Path? What does the V stand for? Wise
view.
Yeah, the I of Visa. Wise
intention,
yeah. The S,
speech.
Wise speech, yep. The A,
action.
Wise action. The L, Visa Le MC. We're in France, okay? What's the L? Wise livelihood. What's the E? Wise effort. What's the M? Now we're in MC, so MasterCard MC. Wise
mindfulness.
And the C, wise concentration. Now you know the entire path of awakening it, and you have to remember it by thinking of a credit card. That's pretty weird. And you have to remember you're in France and not, like, you know, Germany or I don't know where. So anyway, but so, and the Eightfold Path has three parts to it. Wise view, wise intention is actually aligning our thoughts as best we can with reality. That's important. Again, we're not throwing away thinking. We're just aligning thinking with how things are in our experience. And so wise view, I won't unpack it too much, but it's things like interdependence, you know, understanding karma, not in a sort of woo-woo way, but really in a practical way. I think of karma basically as mental habit. You know, the more we practice something, the easier it becomes. The more I, you know, get angry at things, the easier it becomes to be angry. The more I practice kindness or paying attention, the easier it is to pay attention and practice kindness. So there's karma happening on this retreat. You have really good karma, quote unquote. Let's say helpful karma. Just take the judgment out of it. You've practiced a lot of mindfulness. By accident, you're being mindful now. You don't always have to try. Sometimes it just happens because you have all this good effort behind you. For me, that is the simplest understanding of karma. And the rest is very difficult. But so wise view, wise intention is having your actions come from helpful motivations. Basically, generosity, love, wisdom, which are the opposite of greed, aversion, delusion. I'm starting to go through a lot of stuff really quick. Okay, so that's wise view. Wise intention is really all about wisdom. So that's the wisdom part of the path. And then the middle part of the path, wise, I have to still do the acronym, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, is about ethics, you know. And remember, Buddhist monastics have, you know, hundreds of ethical guidelines. We undertook the five, just the first five, which are quite profound. So so paying attention to our behavior is very, very important. Is our behavior causing harm, or is our behavior causing benefit? So important. The more unskillful your actions, the more harm you cause in the world, but you harm yourself, because if you were to sit down on retreat and you've done a bunch of really unskillful stuff, that is going to come back to haunt you. And so all the things I said about ethical guidelines, one of them is a protection for yourself. You're protecting yourself from regret and remorse. So that's kind of the middle section of the Eightfold Path. And then the third is meditation. So it's the effort, mindfulness, concentration. And so just remember where we are. Four Noble Truths. Now I'm unpacking the fourth Noble Truth, the path to happy no matter what. And now I'm going to jump into wise mindfulness. And the Buddha taught mindfulness, to be mindful of four very sort of foundational areas of our life, the most basic areas of our life. Well, the two that are the most basic division in our experience is the physical and the mental. That seems like maybe, isn't that sort of everything? There's the physical world, all of our five physical senses and nature, everything inside and outside that's physical, and then everything that's mental. Those are two of the four foundations. Well, but the Buddha added another one, and that is to actually look for some of the key structures of the teachings in your experience. So you would look for things like the five hindrances, the six sense bases, which we've been working with, the six senses, seven factors of enlightenment, and then, oh, it ends with Four Noble Truths. That's interesting. So this is sort of holographic. Four Noble Truths. Fourth truth is the Eightfold Path. The seventh element of the Eightfold Path is wise mindfulness. And then the fourth element of mindfulness is the Four Noble Truths. Or it's the end of all the sets. So anyway, it's a huge, very intricate map of how to live your life so that you can actually be more at ease with feeling tone. So, but I haven't told you the fourth foundation. It sort of makes sense, right? We break the world up. I want to be mindful of the physical world and the mental world, and I also want to be mindful of the key Buddhist teachings in my experience. But so what's the fourth? The fourth is just a quality. It's a quality that's universal in all experiences. And it's the only quality the Buddha named in his mindfulness instructions. And it is feeling tone. So whether we're mindful of body, whether we're mindful of mind, whether we're watching the way key Buddhist teachings unfold in our experience, the Buddha recommended we always notice feeling tone. That's how important it is. So now you sort of see the way feeling tone fits into like the whole Dharma path. And there's a lot I'm omitting, but I'm making it very simple. And so in mindfulness, the quality that's very important to notice Whatever is happening is feeling toed. So he's really singling it out. Now, to sort of guide you towards the sentence, the Eightfold Path is very like holographic. Everything, if you practice one of the things really well, the others come on board too. So if you practice, you know, non-harming really well, you have to start being really mindful and paying attention to your speech and your thoughts and your physical actions. But I would kind of argue that of the eight, the mindfulness is the one that is required, you know, in all the others. To have wise view, you really have to start getting beyond all your stories and start seeing clearly through mindfulness. To have wise intention, you need to be mindful to know if your intentions are coming from a helpful or unhelpful place. To be ethical and not harm, you have to have a lot of mindfulness of your speech, your actions, and then your work, what you're doing at work. So my bias, and I'll ask you if you agree with me later, my bias is that the linchpin, the really key element of the Eightfold Path is mindfulness. And that's one reason why in the West, as our teachers brought over Dharma from the East, and they mostly brought over meditation because of how important mindfulness is. Mindfulness really is the key to our awakening. And the Buddha said, be mindful of feeling tone. Whatever's happening, notice feeling tone. Okay, I think now we're ready for the sentence. So, our happiness lies not in whether or not we're having a pleasant experience. Our happiness lies in our relationship with feeling tone. We will be unhappy when our relationship is reactive, and we will be happy when it's connected or responsive. So, here comes the sentence. The essence of the Buddhist path is to replace reacting to feeling tone with mindfulness of feeling tone. Ta-da! Are you glad I'm done, or?
Say it again.
Does anyone want to try to say it?
Can you spray paint it on the wall?
Do some tagging. Does anyone want to care to try to say it? I'll say it one more time and then you give it a try. Because this is one, I've taught this a lot and people forget it very easily. The essence of the Buddhist path is to replace reacting to feeling tone with mindfulness of feeling tone. And when I say reacting, remember what I mean, greed, aversion, delusion. So there's a lot in here. Anyone want to try to say it?
The essence of the Buddha's path is...
not reaction to feeling tone.
Exactly. Or replace reaction to feeling tone.
Replace reaction to feeling tone.
With mindfulness of feeling tone. Right. It's actually really simple. It's incredibly profound. This is the human conundrum solved, if you want it. What is the human conundrum? Remember what I started out saying. We only know how to be happy if it's pleasant. The Buddha is saying, this is what you do to be happy no matter what. You replace greed for the pleasure, aversion to the unpleasant, and ignoring the neutral, you replace it with mindfulness of pleasant, mindfulness of unpleasant, and mindfulness of neutral. So that's a much more complicated way of saying the sentence. So the practice we've been working with today, you have set yourself up where you learn to be mindful of breath, body, sensations, emotions, thoughts, sight, sound, thought, image, everything, right? And so now you've done that, and then remember what the Buddha advises. Now notice the feeling tone in it. Does this make sense to you? That feeling tone, in fact, is the crux issue. Does that make sense, first of all?
Yes.
And then does it make sense to you that mindfulness of feeling tone is a way to be happy no matter what? That's a bigger ask. Does that make sense?
No.
Say more. Whoever said no. Yeah, Chase, please.
I don't have more to say, but I don't know. I was thinking about it a lot today, though, actually.
Yeah.
I had already thought of that question, so
yeah.
And the answer was no earlier.
Okay.
So
that's your story, and you're sticking to it. Yeah. Yeah. No, great. I'm glad you're being just straight up, because that's the only way to learn. Is there anything about it that doesn't make sense that you want to name?
Oh, I suppose... I don't know, really. But, just watching feeling tone arise and doesn't seem like the solution for seeing the... Yeah, that's what I was trying to say.
Watching feeling tone arise doesn't seem like the solution.
It doesn't seem to bring about the answer to how to not cling to the feeling tone.
Ah.
Just watch it as... Yeah.
Can people relate? That's it. Like, really? That's it? You know, it's like the person who goes, you know, and travels thousands of miles and crosses rivers and scales to some high cliff of Tibet and asks the sage, what is the meaning of life? And they say, life is like a river. What? I came all this way. Life is like a river? How is that even helpful? So, I'm guessing, see if this is right, it just doesn't seem like that big a deal. Like, I can be mindful of feeling tone, but it doesn't change much, necessarily, in how I'm relating to it. Maybe. Ish.
Yeah, maybe.
We have to then bring in concentration. Because you notice on the Eightfold Path, it's effort, mindfulness, concentration, right? Concentration we can define as the staying power of mindfulness. In Vipassana, it doesn't mean one-pointed. It's defined that way in other traditions, but not in Vipassana. Because in Vipassana, we want to be aware of anything and everything. And so the way we define concentration is the staying power of mindfulness. Is there a continuity? Does mindfulness kind of persist moment to moment? An analogy is a flashlight. You turn the flashlight on, that's mindfulness. You can point it around. But if it doesn't stay on very long, it's hard to see clearly. Concentration is how long does a light stay on? If the light stays on for a while at night, we can look around and see a lot more clearly. And I'm guessing, and this is true for all of us, to really see this more clearly, our mindfulness needs to, you know, have more of that staying power where we can just keep seeing, you know, oh yeah. And I want to get a show of hands. How many of you just had an experience where, you know, a moment or two or maybe a little while where you could just pay attention to knee pain or some pain in the body, back pain, whatever, or an itch, and you paid attention to it and you stayed with it, and then it's kind of like, oh, this isn't so bad. I can just be with this. And just, anyone had this experience in your practice? That's, you know, just about everybody, it looks like. Now, if you take that and just grow that, and your practice becomes stronger and stronger and stronger, what starts happening is, first of all, experience starts coming and going very quickly. And another thing that happens is what we talked about two nights ago. We start to not be just parked in the sixth, I can't say this word, since gate number six is easier to say, we're not just riveted with thoughts all the time. We start to get a lot of, oh, sensation, sound, sensation. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's an image, there's a thought. It's all, it becomes much more equalized. There's a lot more physical experience. I didn't hear that. Somebody's beeper alarm went off at 8. But now we're doing Q&A, so this isn't the talk. Slippery guy. Anyway, where was I?
You were back to the kerfuffle.
Which one? There's so many. Oh, the sixth sense. Thank you. So there's a lot more physical experience. And the thoughts aren't, and some of you are, you know, reporting this. It's like, wow, I pay attention to thinking and it just doesn't last very long. I'm like, yeah, that's great. That's a great insight. If I'm not feeding my thoughts, it doesn't have a lot of energy. So we start to notice that things are coming and going more quickly. And then we start to notice, just like everything, you all just, you know, you all raise your hand, basically like, oh, I can be with more and more unpleasantness because the mindfulness is more and more strong. And it's actually backing us into, it's not like zippity-doo-da, you know, like walking on sunshine happiness. It's like more like ease, contentment, satisfaction, equanimity. Really, it's just a big, I'm right here. I'm just right here, and it's profound rest of mind, and that's, you know, that's a little glimpse into awakening. And of course, there's joy. There's a misunderstanding that equanimity is this. It's the radical acceptance of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. The flux of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. That's not a just like, eh, whatever, it's all good. You know, the Greg Brown song, one cool remove. Like the Buddha, one cool remove. You know, and that just seems to like connote indifference. Not at all. We're alive, we're connected. Life is vivid. Life is more vivid, but more, what's the word? Insubstantial. More vivid. More just like air. Coming back then, when our mindfulness grows in strength and the concentration gets boosted and the two together, now we're like, wow, this flashlight's just staying on longer. I can really look around. It'll make more sense. So that's a possible answer. I don't know if that fits or not, but I'm going to quickly say a few things and then wrap up about how we work with each quality. With pleasant, there's a great William Blake line, what we need to learn to do with pleasant is kiss the joy as it flies. You know, this is very old school English. So he writes, he, and just insert, you know, the correct pronoun in your mind for what works. But what William Blake wrote was, he who binds himself to joy does the winged life destroy. But he who kisses the joy as it flies, lives in eternity's sunrise. He's saying the way, the unattached relationship with pleasure is enjoyment. Enjoyment is not greed. Actually, to enjoy something, you can't be scared it's going to leave. If you're scared that sunset, you know, it's just tangerine and pink and, you know, gold. And I'm like, but I just, don't go. You know, that's greed. And I'm trying to get something from it. Whereas enjoyment is like, check it out, you know. It's like this. And that's the fists, the hands are open. But enjoyment has built into it, it's sort of like that wisdom, enjoy it while it lasts. And so if you're mindful of pleasant, here's what's really cool. You're going to enjoy it more because you're actually going to, you know, like taste the pear. Crunch pie, is that the right name? Pear. You're going to taste it. So you're going to enjoy it more. But in the process of enjoying it, you will not believe peach pie, pear pie, can save me or complete me. It's hella good, and that's what it is. Straight up, that's it. It's just hella good, and that's all it is. That's pretty damn good. But it's not going to give me, this is such a wet blanket to say, it's not going to give me the lasting happiness I seek. So that's what's cool about really being mindful of pleasure. You're going to enjoy it more and be less attached because you're just with it, with it, with it. And now it ends and it's like, oh, so now I'm with this. Time to get up. Time to go to the dish station. Right? There's no big deal. So don't be afraid of being mindful of pleasure. In the order of things, we, of course, prefer pleasure the most. But second on the list is not neutral, typically. Second on the list is unpleasant. Ego loves a problem. And unpleasant is a problem. Like, why do we like Tabasco so much? Why do we like really hot jalapenos? It's really spicy. If you really tune into that, that's unpleasant. But I'm like, damn, this meal's got pizzazz, like hellfire. You know, it's just like, you know, there's that Saturday Night Live skit of the hot skit of buffalo hot wings that the guy dies because he eats them. Anyway, we'll take Tabasco any day over just like mashed potatoes.
Just put the Tabasco on the mashed potatoes.
Hell yeah! Now my tongue's on fire. I'm alive. This is good. Something's happening. We are literally in this culture in an arms race, a sensory arms race. Have you noticed the way everything has to be extreme now? I just for yucks, I just Googled extreme plus potato chips just to see if those combination existed. It did. Check it out. The whole shebang, extreme ripple potato chips. Mission restaurant style tortilla triangles with extreme cheese. Picard's extreme kettle-style dill pickle pucker potato chip. This is real. These are real potato chips. Pringle extreme blazing buffalo wing super stack. Damn. It's going to complete me. And then you're like a mile down the road and you ate a whole bag of chips and you're just like, oh, God. And then you hit the truck ahead of you because you're like this. Anyway. I'm not kidding, there's even extreme motor oil. Like, that's really trying to upsell something. This motor oil's extreme. Well, maybe if you drink it, I don't know what's extreme about motor oil. But we are like intensity junkies, and we want possess. And so we actually, you know, like neutral is like ego death. It's like, just shoot me. Are you kidding me? Neutral? Are you kidding me? Beige. You know, like pictured like some old tan Volkswagen, you know, from the like 60s. You know. But really, and Dave talked about this morning, when we're mindful of neutral, it's a freaking relief. Oh my God. Could I just be with the simple rise and fall of my belly when I am? Right? It's just like so nice just to feel our belly. I mean, when I'm really with it, right? It's like, oh my God, I'm just right here. Ugh. Thank you. It becomes blessedly neutral. If you would, we've been doing this in our practice, just orient to the space in the room. Do that thing right now, right here, of your gaze as wide and tall. See the big space. And relax and just kind of receive this space. How do you feel? Just to notice space. It's so neutral. Space is so neutral. But when we notice space, our mind can become spacious. Neutral is the gateway to being. Our minds, we're so hopped up on extreme potato chips that it's very hard to just come into being. But neutral is the gateway. We recommend your meditation anchor is neutral, because when mindfulness grows with it, you start to go towards contentment and ease. So, we'll see whether your experience can sort of buy the hype that, you know, the Buddhism, the way we practice it in Theravada. And I just spoke from the mindfulness side. There's a whole metta side too, but from the mindfulness side, the essence of our path is to replace reacting to feeling tone with awareness of feeling tone. The end.
Or just put the bathroom across in your
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.